CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 99, with Dr. Rich Davidson. Critical lessons for residents, fellows, and young surgeons. This you have to hear. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Richard Davidson at the University of Colorado. You've seen him on the podium countless times. I learned half my little secrets about cataract, cornea, anterior segment surgery from him. And now we have a chance to talk to him live. Welcome to our podcast, Rich.
Thanks, Uday. You are way too kind. I think I've learned a lot more from you, but I appreciate the introduction. Thanks so much.
Yeah, we're like around the same age. I think we both did, like, I did college 92, med school 96, residency 2000. So we're like pretty close, right?
Yeah, we're within a year. I took a year off between college and med school, but we're essentially the same age. We're good. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Great. So yeah, I already did my homework. I know you went to GW, George Washington University in Washington, D.C., yep, for undergrad. Then you did Hahnemann Med, yep, School in Philly, yep, which I guess is now kind of moved into the Drexel umbrella.
Yep.
And then you were a Wills resident. And then you came out to California for UC Davis with Mark Manis for your and Dr. Schwab for, yep, your cornea fellowship. But then, yep, we lost you to Colorado.
You lost me to Colorado. I mean, Davis was amazing, and it was such a great year. But I love living in Colorado, and it's just funny how things work out. You know, I came to Colorado hoping to settle there, and 22 years later, I'm still here, which is awesome.
So this is like the only job you've ever had. You graduated your training, and this, yes, is your first job, and it's your only job.
It's my only job. It's funny because I really had no interest into going into academics. I thought for sure I was going to do private practice. But when I was looking for jobs in Colorado, I just wasn't finding the right fit in a private practice job. And literally, probably like March of my fellowship year, I found a job opening at the university. I'm like, oh, this is great. I'll do it for a year. Then I'll go into private practice. And 22 years later, it's my only job. I'm still there.
That's awesome. Now, cool. For our podcast attracts all listeners, all ages, yes, but a lot of them skew to the 30s and 40s. Yes. So I want to tell you, your first job in general is like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. It's great and all. And if that could be the one you're with forever, bless you. What an incredible situation. But it's okay if you kind of change gears a couple of times to find the right fit.
Absolutely. And I tell our residents that too. I tell my residents that I'm the anomaly here. You know, this is not the typical situation where you come out and have the same job. Most people are going to switch around a little bit. And I think it's totally normal to switch around. You don't know exactly what you're going to be like when you get out, or maybe you join a toxic relationship, whatever it is. You can learn from each step along the way, but, you know, don't beat yourself up if the first job doesn't work out.
Right. I mean, ultimately, do what's best for you, your family, your situation. Find your right fit, find your happiness, and it's okay. What's great for someone else may not be great for you, and vice versa.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
So I first learned about you because I've seen you on the podium a lot, but two of my former residents years ago, Jameson Engel, got to, yep, be at least 10, 12 years ago, and then Jamie Alexander, like these guys were about 2 years apart.
Yes.
They were amazing residents. And then they did your fellowship, and they could say nothing but amazing things like, oh my gosh, best fellowship ever. Thank you for you know, going to bat for me to give me this fellowship.
Well, no, thank you for going to bat for them, because you have no idea how much that means to us. Like when someone like you makes a call, it makes a huge difference for us. And they are both superstars. I mean, Jameson's killing it in Reno, Nevada. And Jamie's in Dallas, Fort Worth. Jamie, I spoke to a couple months ago. She told me she was the highest volume surgeon in her surgery center, which is a big surgery center in the Dallas, Fort Worth area. I mean, I'm just so proud of all of them. And I think you would agree. I mean, the academic side of things, training residents and fellows, it, for me, is some of the most gratifying things when I look back on my career. And so the two of them are just amazing. But we might not have had them if you hadn't made the call. So it's awesome.
Well, when you have residents like that, like, I will bend over backwards for you. Those guys were so amazing.
Yes.
And I think, you know, what's funny it boils down to is they both had two things in common: an incredible work ethic and incredible enthusiasm.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. And they're still like that today. And to any residents or fellows who are watching out there, I would say if you have a program that you want to go to, like for fellowship or anything, you know, ophthalmology is a small world. It gets even smaller when you're in your subspecialty. So don't hesitate to have a mentor pick up the phone and call. It makes a big difference for those of us who are making the decisions.
Yeah, that begs the question to me, because, you know, I was in academics too, half-time.
Yep.
From the year 2000 to 2022, and I had a ton of residents, and it was 8 residents a year for 22 years, so almost 200 residents.
That's a lot.
And it was a fantastic time. But the problem now is, because the way that academia has changed, Now there's no USMLE step one score anymore.
Yes.
Most med schools have no more grades, just pass fail or pass now, pass later. We're all like, you know, warm and fuzzy. We're all special snowflakes together. And then even the letters of rec look, gosh, almost the same.
It is. And there are certain things I look for. I totally agree. And, you know, for years we struggled with this. And I'm not on the admissions committee anymore right now, just because I have some other conflicts with the days that we do resident interviews. But for years we were battling with, you know, grade inflation. Although when you do it for enough time, I'm sure you know, you get to know which schools are putting out, you know, the good people. And for fellowship, I look for really some certain clues. You know, for our fellowship, it's not a good fellowship for people who are not comfortable with cataract surgery. You know, we will teach you everything else, but we assume that you're going to come in comfortable with cataract surgery. So we are looking for programs that really give residents a great cataract experience, and they come in with a lot of, you know, good numbers. That's how we differentiate. But you're right, you know, you kind of have to read between the lines. We're looking for certain keywords, like one of the most gifted surgeons I've seen, or, you know, we'll do 300 cataracts, you know, because otherwise they do all kind of run together. And same with the purple.
It's hard to differentiate them. But yeah, for me, I think the two factors which they both had were they're very hardworking, incredible work ethic, and both incredibly enthusiastic. Like, we have a very tough case coming up. I don't know if you want to do it. I want to do it. They're like, they're gung-ho. Let's do this. I will prepare. I will study. We'll make it happen.
Yeah. And I'm so proud of them. I've heard they're just such superstars in the field nowadays. And it's really cool to see.
Yeah, they're kind of like our kids in common here, buddy.
That's what I see. Exactly. I love it. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, I had the chance of like holding their hands for like FACO number one, like, try it this way. And then you had the chance of obviously refining their skills for all this incredible corneal anterior segment surgery.
I had the easier job. It's hard when you're doing the July cataracts, for sure. It's just like, I use the analogy, it's kind of like teaching your kids to drive. Like, you're so close, but you can't always take over. You know what I mean? And so, you know, when you're teaching them to drive, like, you're trying to coach them along and you're right in the passenger seat, but you don't have that emergency brake. And, you know, same thing with cataract surgery. You know, you try and step in when it's appropriate and hopefully mitigate any complications, but we can't always. And so the July cataracts that you were doing, definitely stressful.
It took a little bit of time off my life, but it was well worth it. It was an incredible investment. But now, how your fellowship has really skyrocketed in terms of, I mean, all my residents like, oh, I love that fellowship. I want to do that fellowship. I want to interview for that fellowship. How you obviously are offering something amazing in your fellowship. Tell me more about it.
Well, thank you. First of all, I appreciate the accolades. But I am very proud of the fellowship. I think, you know, like anything, it's evolved over the years. And I think what I'm most proud about the fellowship is that we offer a really good academic, but also a very practical experience. Meaning, I always tell people during the interview process, I will be disappointed if you leave here feeling like you weren't either exposed to something or that you don't feel comfortable doing it. Because, you know, this year is an optional year for you. You don't have to do it. So we really want you to get the most out of it. I think what really balances things out is, number one, you know, we do a lot of surgery, you know, and the fellows in the OR 2 to 3 days a week. And so it's a lot of cases. Number two, they're doing the hard, complex academic cases, the corneal transplants, the DSEC, the DMEC, but they're also doing a lot of premium lens cataract surgery. And I think that's really what differentiates us a lot. Yeah, we use femtosecond laser. We're doing a lot of premium lenses. So they're getting to see the business side of things too. Because the reality is, like, you have to engage in this technology when you're out. And so we can't have this ivory tower mentality that premium lenses are bad, or we're not going to talk to patients about paying out of pocket, you know, things like that. So they're getting the real everyday thing that you would probably see more in a private practice fellowship than you would in an academic fellowship. And then we have a really good partnership with the Air Force Academy, and they're getting hundreds of refractive cases. So I think that's always the hardest part about fellowships in cornea, is that how do you get a critical mass of refractive patients? You can offer a discount, things like that, but you still don't get the numbers. And they're getting hundreds of PRK, you know, dozens of LASIK. They're getting certified in ICL. They're getting certified in SMILE. So it really is a well-balanced fellowship. And I think all of those components have really made it quite competitive, and we're really proud of it.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic fellowship. I mean, my two residents who did it loved it. They even acclimated to living at, you know, mile high altitude. So if you don't know, Denver is 5,280 feet above sea level, which is 1 mile, which in metric is probably like 1,600 meters.
That's right.
So it's very high altitude. It's a different city.
It's a great city. And that's right, for the international people who are not familiar with Denver, it is a higher altitude and it's very, very dry here. So my hands are cracked and they just take a beating during the winter, but it is a great place to live.
And it's also kind of perfect for you because I know, in addition to being a very passionate ophthalmologist, you're a passionate skier.
I do love to ski. I do love to ski.
And right. So how did this start? Because you weren't always in Denver.
No. I mean, I grew up on the East Coast. So, you know, my first time skiing was at Camelback Mountain in the Poconos of Pennsylvania. And thankfully, my mother took us skiing and my sister and I mean, I have vivid memories. This is like 1978, where it took like literally 10 minutes to get our skis on and just to get to the lift. So it was, she had to deal with the disaster of us just one kid falling, the next kid falling, you know. But my sister and I were both hooked, and I just always wanted to live out west. And so it worked out so well to be out here and to raise my kids out here. It's been a privilege. They haven't had the privilege of skiing in the Poconos yet. No, it's just such a wonderful place to live. And it's such a great sport to do as a family and with my kids. And so in 2 weeks, we're going on a trip together. And it's really, really fun. And it's something you can do throughout your lifetime. I mean, I have patients in their 80s who are still very active skiers. And it's a really great way to be outside. And I feel lucky to live here. The only problem in Denver is the traffic. So you gotta plan around the traffic. But otherwise, it's very accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine the skiing in Colorado is a whole lot different than the skiing in the Poconos.
It is. But, you know, when I grew up in the Poconos, it's all I knew. I had a great time. My friends and I would go out. You know, when it's all you know, it was awesome. But, you know, it was still quite a good experience. But out here, we're definitely spoiled.
Well, you surpassed me. I started off skiing as a young kid, too. But I'm still stuck at, like, the snowplow. I remember they teach me, like, make a slice a pizza or French fries.
Exactly.
That's still where my brain's at. I've not progressed at all in skiing.
It's funny how some people do, some people don't. Like, I just feel very lucky that I was kind of thrown into it a lot as a kid and then went on some pretty big trips. It's almost like cataract surgery. You know, if you just do a day or two here, it's harder. But I went on some like week-long trips, you know, when I was a kid. And that repetition, 7 days in a row or 6 days in a row, really helps. It's like doing cataracts. You know, the days the residents get five or six in a row is so much better than when they get just one and then 2 weeks pass and they do two more, you know. So I think that helped me quite a bit with skiing.
No, it does for sure. I mean, you got to get your reps in. You got to get the time in the OR. And I think that's probably the key in your fellowship is that, as you're saying, your fellows are doing 2-3 days a week in the OR and they're finishing in 1 year a fantastic volume of surgery.
It's hundreds. I think our fellow this year, you know, we're in December, already has over 200 cataracts. He's done a bunch of LASIK and PRK and, you know, I don't know how many transplants, stuff like that. So yeah, it's great. And I think it's the reps. And, you know, we tell people, you know, like I said, if you're going to take this year, an optional year, we want you getting your hands dirty. Otherwise, it's not the fellowship where you're going to sit around and watch us do surgery. There's nothing that makes me prouder than at the end of the year, if I don't have to scrub the entire day, if I can hand every case off to the fellow, then I feel like I've done a good job.
Right. I would do the same thing at the end of residency, the last 6 months of residency. I mostly want to sit there in the operating room and watch through the scope.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you just get, I don't even want to scrub.
Exactly. Let them, because I think they need that autonomy too. You know, it's, you know, as you know, when you get out on your own, those first couple of cases can be nerve wracking when you know you don't have backup. I want them to know they have the backup, but right. I want them to make all the decisions. And there's something about like not scrubbing that kind of forces them to make the decision, which I like.
Right. As you said, you know, you finish your training, you start on some practice, and you're in the operating room and you look to your left and there's no one there. If you're right, and there's no one there. And you're like, oh, if things go south here, it's on me. Right?
Exactly. And you realize, and that's why it's so important to like stupid things. Like you got to know how to, you know, put the phaco machine together. You need to know how to trouble the phaco machine because you may have a scrub tech that has no idea, maybe their first day and they don't know the intricacies of, you know, how the cassette's supposed to go in, or you have to tighten the tip. You know, there's things like that that they need to learn, which is actually a cool thing about our residency now with the PGY1 year. During their internship year, they do a month-long rotation in the OR where they learn how to scrub, they learn how to set up the tray, they learn how to pass instruments. And I think it's been a great experience for the PGY1s to just get familiar with the OR and to learn the background of how these machines work.
Oh, that's fantastic. What a great idea. Because, in the USA, for our international listeners, you know, ophthalmology residency is now 4 years. It used to be a separate one-year internship and then separate 3 years of residency for ophthalmology. Now it's just combined together in 4 years. And the first year of those 4 years is typically 9 months of general medicine or the rest of the body and 3 months of ophthalmology.
Exactly.
And then the next 3 years are all ophthalmology. So in truth, it's probably 39 months of ophthalmology training.
Exactly. But like no one, when you think about it, like you kind of get thrown in the OR and you hear the names of these instruments, but you don't really know what anything is. So it's nice that they have this month of like, oh, you know, this is a chopper. You know, this is how the machine gets plugged in. This is what happens when you hit the pedal and nothing happens. Like it's really good for them to learn how to troubleshoot.
Yeah, well, you got to start with the basics. You know, on cataractcoach.com, the actual website, not just YouTube stuff. I actually have a free PDF book about learning cataract surgery. And I got a free 25-part curriculum series. It's each lesson is 25 lessons. Each lesson is 30, 40 minutes long. And it even starts off with like, okay, how to have the right mindset, how to choose the first patient for surgery, how to set up the operating room. Let's talk about ergonomics. And then we go through every little detail, how to set up the phaco machine.
It's amazing.
All covered. Yeah.
The ergonomics too. I'll never forget my first case. It was a second year resident, extra cataract surgery. I was so nervous. I didn't think about the ergonomics and my right foot fell asleep during the surgery. I could not feel the pedal and I embarrassingly had to tell my attending, I have to stop for a second. I had to lower my chair. I had to shake out my foot. I mean, it's things like that you don't think about. So the fact that you're dealing with this in the course is amazing. And kudos to you. I mean, the hours you have put in setting this up is amazing. I mean, daily videos, I just give you so much credit because I know what it's like to edit one video. Can't imagine doing it every day. I mean, it's really, you deserve a lot of credit. So thank you. I mean, you're really,
It's a passion project. It's either I'm very passionate or I'm crazy or probably a combination of both.
It's incredible passion and it's really valuable. I mean, you really are the go-to resource for all the residents and fellows out there, which is amazing. And, but you bring up the point of like, it's the little things like everyone, you know, you watch cataract surgery when you're first watching, it looks so easy. And then you do your first case and you're like, where do I put my hands? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, we've all struggled with making a paracentesis. You know, it's the stuff that you would think would be so basic when you go to do it yourself for the first time is a little bit more challenging.
Yeah, and surprisingly, even little changes can have that effect. This week I was in the operating room, I had a very busy order. I was lecturing in Brazil, so I come back and they have like double the volume I normally do.
Yeah.
And so the surgery center, we're cranking through all these cases, and they're like, oh, we ran out of those gurneys. Can I put you in the next patient in the other gurney? I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. Just wear anything. And they bring in the operating room and just like, the position's all set up. And I mean, I just couldn't quite get comfortable.
It's the worst feeling. It's like when you can't get comfortable or you don't have good exposure, let's say the patient's really deep set or they can't hold still or they have a Bell's phenomenon, like that makes an easy case really hard. And it could be as simple as that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and that's what we have to deal with on a daily basis. It's comfort, it's height, or sometimes I'll walk in the room and the anesthesia person will have put this big donut under their neck, so their head's like tilted this way. I'm like, it's like they're trying to get a spot, but I'm like, it's like 8 to 10 minutes. Can you just like let me set the patient up, please? You know, it is funny because it matters. You know, or if the draping doesn't go well and there's lashes, you know, whatever it is, all those little things matter as far as the ease of which you get through the case.
100%. It's like. Sometimes residents are worried about like, well, do they have the right chopper on the tray? It's like, you know what? Let's start with one thing simple.
Right.
Can we get the patient's iris parallel to the floor? Because right now the patient's chin is tucked in and you're going to cry and suffer the entire case.
It's so true. And also like, so I operate with the pedals, which is different than most people do. I use the microscope on my right foot and the phaco pedal on the left foot. Most people do the opposite. I can do it either way because the residents usually do the opposite. But I tell them like, you should get used to doing it however you, in different ways. And, you know, I just feel lucky, you know, when you operate in other countries, you realize, you know, you may not have viscoelastic, you know what I mean? Like, you know, so like we are so spoiled in the US to have the best instruments, unlimited viscoelastic, things like that. You know, it's so interesting. So I try and tell the residents, like, you may not have the chopper you want. You may have to make do with whatever they give you, or if the chopper breaks or whatever it is, like get used to multiple things. And that's why it's kind of good to operate with different attendings, because we're all going to do things differently and you can kind of pick and choose what you like.
Right. I mean, I used to do a ton of live surgery events for some of the big companies from buying the early 2000s to the late 2000s. And you don't know the challenge. We're in a foreign operating room.
Yes.
With a patient doesn't speak your language. I made the mistake once of saying I was operating in Italy for a live surgery event. And Lucio Boratto's meeting.
That's great. Yeah.
Amazing meeting. Video Catarata Refractiva in Milano. And he said, okay, what do you want for anesthesia? I said, okay, it's topical. So literally they bring the patient in the room, this old grandma, and
They say, here's your bottle of tetracaine, enjoy. I'm like, no, I mean also some IV sedation, some benzodiazepine, something.
Exactly.
And they're like, oh, you didn't tell us that. You said topical. You're topical.
Yeah, right.
I finally bring the rep over.
Very literal, right? Yeah.
Right. I say, could you tell the patient that she looks exactly like my grandmother and I will treat her just like my grandmother? And he tells her that. And then like puts her at ease. And then I say, okay, how do you say, look at the lights? And then I learned, Signora, por favore, guarda la luce, hey?
You're pretty good. That's pretty good. No, but I mean, I think everyone should have the experience in operating in another country. It makes you appreciate what we have in the States. I mean, it's really challenging at times. I've had, you know, ORs where the windows open. I mean, birds have flown in. I mean, it's just a different experience sometimes. And so it forces you to really think on your feet. And yeah, especially to realize how fortunate we are in the States to have like the best equipment, like I said, and access to viscoelastic, things like that.
Yeah, we're spoiled rotten. If you're a young ophthalmologist who's done, let's say, at least 1,000 cases,
yeah,
you've got a good number on your belt, I encourage you to do a charity surgery mission trip anywhere on the planet.
Yeah. It's very helpful. And we're privileged to be able to do stuff like that, or to go, you know, help another surgeon learn a new technique, whatever it is. We're very privileged to be able to go to these other countries and do that.
Yeah, because you'll get the most challenging cases. And oftentimes you have more rudimentary equipment than you're used to.
Exactly.
And that really tests your mettle as a surgeon.
Exactly.
Can you get through this case?
Yeah.
And you're probably also jet lagged by about 10 or 12 hours.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and it's important to remember the history of all this too. Like I was talking to some residents yesterday. I told them, you know, latanoprost came out when I was a resident. You know, there was no MIGs. It was tubes and traps. Like, you know, it's easy to forget the history. You know, the phaco machine vitrectomy cut rate was 400 back then. Like, it's easy to kind of lose track of what the history was of all the equipment that we use and how these techniques evolved and how people did make do with less for many, many years.
Right. That's actually a really critically important lesson about the evolution of our field in terms of new technology, new techniques. Yeah. Because when you did your fellowship, there was no lamellar surgery.
Nothing. No DSEC, no DMEC. Wasn't even on the radar screen. I mean,
you're self-taught.
Yeah, I mean, it was PK for everything. Everyone got, you had Fuchs dystrophy, you got a full thickness corneal transplant. Isn't that crazy? And it seems
today like, it's crazy, but back then it was that was the dogma.
It's all you could do. And it is amazing to think of it because that changed so rapidly. But even then, like even as DSEC and DMEC were developing, I mean, at the beginning, none of us really knew what we were doing. I mean, Mark Terry was doing a lot. Frank Price was doing a lot. Garrett Mellis was obviously, you know, doing a lot. You know, those three were kind of leading the field. The rest of us were kind of figuring this out along the way. And, you know, we had our iBank coming into the OR. We're cutting tissue in the OR with the iBank. I mean, now you order, it's preloaded, ready to go.
But yeah,
like, no so one easy. Knew how to do this at the time. And, you know, we were doing grafts that were like 100, you know, we're doing DSEC grafts that were 150 microns thick. You look at the OCT and it fills the entire anterior chamber. So it is amazing. And that wasn't that long ago. That was maybe, you know, 14, 15 years ago. So it is amazing how things evolve. And it's easy if you're just coming up in ophthalmology now to not really have any perspective on that.
Right. And even more so, it's going to change. You think you do your fellowship now and become an expert at DMEC. Yeah. Okay, great. But you know what we're having in the very near future? Injectable endothelial cell. Done.
We tell that. We say that in every fellowship interview. Said, we're going to teach you these skills. You're not going to be doing it in 5 years. You're going to be doing injectable cells, and that's going to change. Yeah, for endothelial keratoplasty, you know, you're not going to be doing most likely DSAC, DMAC, or any of those procedures.
Yeah, what's the saying? In ophthalmology, the only constant is change.
It's true, but that's what I love about it too, and I think that's probably what you love about it too. I mean, think about all the new technology. The IOL technology is incredible. I mean, when you think about how much that's evolved over the past 20 years and how we can offer our patients such exquisitely good vision nowadays, it's really pretty cool.
It is. You know, I always say I'm an enthusiast. When it comes to ophthalmology, I'm an enthusiast. Because
I like that term. That's good.
Well, because I have enthusiasm to learn about all the new stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not so fixated on whatever I learned in the past, because I just see that as like, that was great history. And like, what's next in the future? I want to learn more and more.
Absolutely. And I think that's the key to what we do, is to know that it's going to change. I think anyone going into ophthalmology, you have to understand that like what you're doing today is going to be a lot different than what you're going to be doing 5 years from now. You have to go in kind of being a lifelong learner and knowing you have to adapt. Otherwise, if you don't adapt to new technology, you're going to fall behind and you're not going to be able to offer, you know, the best things for your patients. The one thing I would say, though, is that you still have to be careful about, like, you have to choose wisely when you want to be an early adopter and when you don't. Like, certain technologies we were early adopters for, certain ones we weren't. And, you know, I think for the most part, we made good decisions, you know, because some technology, it's easy to get on the bandwagon. You go to the academy or ASCRS and the booth is filled. And then the next year they're out of business. You know what I mean? So you kind of have to, you know, pick and choose a little bit. But I think you have to go into our field knowing that things are going to evolve.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. I mean, just kind of being prepared. I like that interview question for your fellows. Like, okay, we're going to teach you all this stuff, but you may not be doing this in the future.
Yeah, most likely not. Or you'll do a variation of it. It's not going to be the way we taught you. But hopefully we've taught you the way to address new techniques and to figure things out on your own. That's really what it's about. Because all we're doing, you know, as surgeons, we're problem solving, you know, and no two cases are the same.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, gosh. The neat part too is, you know, you look back, like when I was a resident, there was no, of course we talk about, you know, lamellar surgery, but yeah, there was no anti-VEGF. There was no OCT machine.
Nothing. I said that last night. I was with the residents. No OCT. None of this. I mean, everyone got a fluorescein if you thought they had CD. Yeah, I mean, it is amazing how these past 20 years, no OCT, look at how OCT has, it has changed the way we practice medicine. Anti-VEGF has changed the way we practice medicine. I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible. So,
and right, in the future, even more stuff's coming. That's why I always say, don't be worried about what the future holds and the new technology. Will it? It's going to be amazing.
It's exciting.
But you just need to be prepared. I think you said it best. You got to be a lifelong learner.
You do. Otherwise, you know, your skills are going to get stale. And you're going to fall behind. And, you know, you have to be ready to offer this technology to the patients as long as you feel like it's appropriate technology. Because it's the best thing to do. It's the best thing for your practice, the best thing to do for our patients. You know, it's amazing to me that, you know, we've had premium lenses for almost 20 years now, since 2005. And still only about 20 to 25% of surgeons offer this technology on a regular basis. And I think that's shocking. You know, that's shocking to me. And it's actually disappointing. We're doing something wrong as educators if they're not embracing this technology. I mean, you do it all the time. I just saw your post the other day. You were trying a new lens. Like, that's what we should all be doing. But I think the problem is a lot of residency programs don't embrace this technology.
Yeah.
And as a result, residents are leaving residency thing. Oh, you know, as a resident, they told me that multifocal lenses were bad. And they didn't put any in. And so therefore they get out. And then there's this hesitancy to embrace the technology because their attendings kept telling them it was bad technology. But it's crazy when you think about it. I mean, we're almost 20 years in and these are some of my happiest patients. And yet a lot of surgeons are still not offering it to them, which I find
That's
shocking and disappointing. Yeah.
I mean, we all know of those few surgeons out there in the community or even in academia who just never advance their skills. Like when, I mean, I know a surgeon today who only performs extracapsular cataract extraction with corneal sclerosis scissors, does not believe in phaco.
Oh, that's amazing. And that's
in 2024, 2025. That's
not acceptable. It's not fair to the patient, right? That's not okay for the patient, in my opinion. You know, so
I agree with you because it fails the golden rule. The golden rule is I give you the same surgery I'd want for my own eye.
That's exactly right. And that's why I think it's not acceptable, you know, because you can never make the argument that that is as good as a phaco.
It's funny, just the path we've come, it's amazing. And then even to think now, what's coming in the future now? Yeah. More automated things, robotic cataract surgery, which I've been involved in with a new company.
Yep.
I mean, it's all coming. And believe me, we can all learn it together. It's not that big of a deal.
Absolutely. But it's exciting. You have to know it's coming, and you can't just poo-poo new technology because you're an old guy and you're like, oh, I'm not going after this. You have to acknowledge the value, and you have to acknowledge the limitations, but you also have to acknowledge the benefits of it too. And I think a lot of residency programs fall short in that regard. And, you know, I've had fellows come in and they're great surgeons, but they never put in a multifocal lens in their residency. And, you know, we have attendings in our program who will not let residents put in multifocal lenses, and yet, you know, that's doing them and the patients a disservice, I think.
Right. I think you're right. I think you have to offer the full spectrum of options for patients.
You do.
And the onus is on you as the surgeon to know all the technologies,
Yes.
And get experience and then offer them as, you know, as the spectrum of care for your patients.
Absolutely. Like in our practice, not everyone in our practice, you know, does this technology very often, but we have an agreement that if they think it's best for the patient, they're going to send it to one of the surgeons in the practice that does offer the technology. And I think that's reasonable. I just think, but pretending like it's bad or doesn't exist is not okay. You know, I think you're going to have a lot of disappointed patients because people talk all the time. I mean, most of my patients who convert to a premium lens heard about it from a friend. And so if they're talking and they're like, hey, why wasn't I offered this? I'd rather someone come in asking for it and me tell them they're not a candidate than for them not to know about it, or, you know, for someone in my practice not to tell them about it, you know, things like that.
No, it makes a lot of sense. You know, I had a video recently on Cataract Coach talking about the ACGME requirements. So that's the American College of Graduate Medical Education. And they say, okay, for your ophthalmology residency, you should do X amount of volume of surgeries. And the cataract number, I don't know if you remember, is 86.
86, right? 86, yeah.
You got to do 86 cataracts as a primary surgeon in your, you know, 4-year ophthalmology residency. And I thought, that's okay, but is that a reasonable number? Should that be different?
I think it's terrible. I mean, I think when you and I were residents, it was even lower. I think it was like in the 60s. I have that in my head, but maybe I'm wrong. But, you know, personally, I think it's too low. I personally didn't feel comfortable until I was over 200 cases. I mean, and I didn't get 200 as a resident. So, you know, I got some as a fellowship, but I don't think I hit 200 till I was attending, or it was right around the time I was starting as an attending. And so to the point where I was like, okay, I'm not as nervous about every little step along the way, you know, because there's so much to think about when you're getting started. And so, yeah, I think 86 is low. What do you think?
I think it's really low. I mean, back 24 years ago, when I finished residency, 25 years ago, I was able to do 200 cases as a resident.
That's amazing.
Right. Our residents today often, like the one, my two residents you trained both did 300.
Yeah. Yeah.
In residency. So I think we're able to achieve that now. But even the mindset's changed. You know, when I started as chief of ophthalmology at UCLA, one of these UCLA big teaching hospitals, all of you, UCLA Med Center, many, many years ago, they were booking, this is no joke, 4 cataracts for the resident per day.
Wow. That's crazy. I believe it. Yeah.
Well, the first thing I did was like, okay, that new number is 10.
Yes.
We're doing 10 a day. 10 in 8 hours is very reasonable. We're going to make it happen.
Yes.
And at that time, I was lucky. I had the support of like the hospital administration and the chief medical officer at the time. She was amazing. She was also chief of anesthesia. She was like, Uday, tell me, what do you need to make this happen? Let's make it happen.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Because somebody, usually it's the opposite. Usually it's like, what are you trying to do? This is our system. You're doing 4. And I'm not going to burn out my nurses. You know what I mean? Like, usually it's that response. So the fact that you're able to switch it is remarkable.
Well, I copied something I learned from Costco,
which
is at Costco. And I love it. I'm a Costco fan for sure. Drinking my sparkling water from Costco right here. And they had a big list on the wall once. This is many years ago, of each cashier and how there was some ranking of how efficient they were.
Yeah.
And a second thing of how accurate they were.
Oh, so they had a dashboard?
Like you've written it like on a marker board. They had like a lot.
That's cool. Like,
so what I started doing was I said, you know what, we need accountability. So I'd make this from, this is maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Every day when they are, we're tracking every time. I want to first know who's the resident operator today, who's attending, who's the circulating nurse, who's the scrub tech, who's the anesthesia. And now case one, what time were we in the room? Yep. When was the timeout done? When was the block done? When was the first incision done? When is the end of the case? When are the drapes off? When are we out of the room? When's the next patient in the room? So when you track all the data and you put it up on the wall, I'm like, and then they saw with this scrub tech, with this circulator, we're slower.
Well, that's
they work harder.
That's the key. The transparency is the key, because a lot of times we'll do time studies, but no one's held directly accountable. Like no one is, you know, publicly shamed. But there is some value to that. If you can do it in a nurturing way that's not embarrassing for the person, maybe they don't realize how slow they are. Maybe they, you know what I mean? And so it's actually very, very good. We're trying to do some modifications right now to speed up our turnover time. And it's a great idea. I mean, to let people see how they perform against their peers is very good. Lately, we've been getting through Epic, our EHR, every week after an OR day, I get a list of all my cases and how much those cases cost, which I think is very interesting. So I can see, you know, which cases cost more, which are less. And I think it's very interesting. And I would vote for transparency to see which surgeons are the most cost efficient surgeons. I don't know if we'll get to that point in our department or not yet, but it'd be interesting to see who is and who isn't.
Well, you bring up a great point.
Yeah.
In our surgery center in Beverly Hills, everything's tracked.
Is it?
So okay, we know for each surgeon, what's your average time for a routine case?
Yeah.
What's your average cost for a routine case? It's back to the penny.
Great.
And we can give you this data and you can learn from it. You have to, you know, listen, do you deserve Monday morning OR time, which is prime time? Or do you deserve Friday 3 p.m. OR time?
That's so everyone awesome. So everyone can see the entire dashboard? Everyone can see each other's
score? There's no secrets.
That's great. I love it.
No secrets at all. Right. Yeah. And so you get to see, okay, these people are very efficient. They're doing a better job. They're getting more. And you also see complication rate.
Yeah, it's really helpful.
So I think just learning from the metrics is super important. And I think it's a benefit to everyone. And the other thing too, is sometimes we tend to say, or residents used to say, well, it's the turnover so slow. It's like, well, actually, if you look at the data here, the time you were in the room to the first incision was 22 minutes.
That's the problem. It's more than just getting in the room. It's the time wasted tucking them in. You know, it's all the stuff we talked about. Like you can lose a whole case by just tucking them in for a 10-minute case, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
Right. So it's like, basically in the room at 8 o'clock and your first incision was 8:22.
Yeah.
That's an issue.
It's a big issue. It's like,
don't blame the nurse.
Yeah. No, you can't blame her. You got to be ready to go. You have to have everything set. Yeah. Do your timeout and go. But some of the positioning stuff is crazy. And it's like, do you want your foot massaged? Do you want an extra pillow? It's like, I'm like, guys, it's going to be over. But before you get the pillow, the case is going to be done, you know? So, but you're right. You have to think about every step. And that's where dashboards like that are so helpful.
Yeah, you can't be too much of a princess or prince in the operating room. You just kind of get the case done.
Yeah.
When the warning sign is when the surgeon says, well, no, to do this cataract, I need this specific chair, this specific this. I need the room lights at exactly 27% intensity. Yo, what are we talking about here? Hello.
I know. It's so true. You just got to be ready. You just have to be safe. You know, you got to make sure the key things in the OR for me are triple checking the lens. Make sure I have the right patient, the right eye, and the right lens. Those three things are by far the most important thing. And after that, I don't care if the nurse plays music. They can play whatever they want. I stopped choosing the music years ago because they probably hated what I chose. So I let the nurse choose the music, and I don't care if the lights are on or off. I just want to make sure that we're safe and the patient's comfortable.
Yeah, ultimately, like you said before, you're the captain of the ship there. So it's the onus on you. So if you're a resident, fellow, attending, whatever you are, you go there and there's a new scrub tech who was used to scrubbing orthopedic cases. Now he or she is scrubbing your cases. The onus is on you to make sure the phaco machine's set up right.
That's right. That's exactly right. Or that you have all the instruments that you need and whatnot. And the things where things kind of fall apart is like in most situations, like most of us don't have a lot of complications, thankfully. So, you know, people start to freak out if you have to set up the enterovitrectomy setting and no one knows where the stuff is. So it's important to make sure your staff knows where it is. Or if they don't, you know where to direct them. Because, you know, obviously that can be a stressful time as a surgeon. And you need to be able to work through that at the same time without throwing instruments or raising your voice. Because that's what the patient's going to remember from the case is if you get excited. So,
but, that's, you know. So, having contingency kits in the operating room.
Yeah, you have to have it ready to go. Yeah.
Yeah, like we have a little bin there. Like if I say anti-protective, I want everything.
It may be once or twice a year that you need it. When you need it, you want it kind of quickly. You don't want them leaving the room scrambling to find stuff.
Right. No, that's so important. And then of course you as the surgeon knowing, okay, how do you set up the anti-protractor? Yeah. You haven't done it in a year.
Yeah.
How
do you do it? What settings do you want for the anti-protractor? So are you going to use cut IA? Are you going to use IA cut? Whatever it is, you need to know those things so you're not freaking out. So, yeah.
Right.
The patient.
Now, that begs the question, too. Are we too? Now, I've retired from teaching residents as of 2022. So it's been a couple years for me. Are we too easy? Have we gone soft? And here's why I say that. I said, I had a situation years ago where I told her, I said, I'll see you tomorrow in the operating room at 7 o'clock. And I said, hey, not 7:01.
Yeah.
And when the resident shows up at 7:04, it's just like, whoa, that's disappointment.
Yeah.
Well, I know, but there was traffic. Well, I live here too. I know there was traffic.
I know. Yeah.
But it seems like now it's like, well, I know it's 4 minutes late, but what about my feelings?
Yeah. I mean, it is a fine line. I think we are probably a little softer than I was, you know. I had the fear of God in me when I was a resident. I felt like I was so afraid of messing anything up or being late. So I felt like the things I could control, I could control. I could show up on time. I could be pleasant. I could be prepared. You know, those were the three things I could control. My, you know, I might not have had the best surgical skills at certain times or whatnot. So that's kind of how I approach things. I think for the most part, you know, the residents work really hard. Our residents are good. But yeah, I think, you know, it's just different now with duty hours. It's different the way they get cases. But in some ways, it's harder too. Like our residents are spread out from four hospitals. Like I had it, I think, easier on call at Wills. We had an emergency department, so everything came to us. Nowadays, our residents are run all over the place. But I know what you mean. I think, you know, I think some of it's resident specific. You know, we've had some residents that are super thirsty. We've had some that have been like showing up 5 or 10 minutes late and not really being prepared for the day or knowing the patient's history, things like that. But I think for the most part, they do pretty well. But, you know, I think we have to be cognizant of, you know, limits of discipline and things like that we have nowadays.
Yeah, for sure. Plus, I mean, to be frank with them, they're learning all the stuff we learned.
Yeah.
Plus all the new stuff in the last 20 years.
It's true.
In the same 4 years of residency.
It's a lot. And I do think, you know, for our residents, you know, call has gotten very, very busy. You know, some of our residents on a weekend are seeing 20 to 30 patients on their own. They're running from hospital to hospital, different consults. It is very busy. I guess, like, you know, let's face it, we're going to have a big shortage of ophthalmologists in the next 10 years. We already have it now. And I'm not sure how we're going to see all this volume of patients.
Should we be training more ophthalmologists? Should we have more residency spots? Or should we go outside of the Medicare granted spots and start having our, you know, extra spots?
What's great? I think Medicare should grant us more spots. But yeah, I think we do need to be training more. We have 6 per year right now. We're trying to go to 7 in the next year or two, I think. But UCLA has 8 per year. Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a need. There's no doubt that there's going to be a shortage because we haven't really raised the number of slots in our careers. You know, it really hasn't changed that much, but yeah, people are living much longer and they need eye care. And so there's going to be shortage of, you know, probably tens of thousands. I don't think we can add enough spots to figure out to really meet the need. I think we're just going to have to add some spots and then figure out how to work smarter, whether it's using optometrists or other, you know, PAs or, you know, for other ancillary care. And I think surgeons are going to have to be doing more surgery.
Yeah. I mean, but then that's the other catch. Should we be testing for surgical skill? Should we be testing for hand-eye coordination? I once asked, could we put all the medical students we're interviewing, could we have them do like the quick study on the IC, the quick test? Well, the dean said it's, you know, is it against the American with Disabilities Act?
That's what everyone says is against ADA. I don't know if this happened to you, but I interviewed at one program in the Midwest. I'm not going to name the program, but I did have to do a dexterity test when I interviewed for residency. There was a Petri dish full of BBs, and I was given a jeweler's forceps, a non-tooth forceps. I had to transfer the BBs into a vial, like a pill vial that had an opening that was just large enough for the BB to enter. And so I had to go, you know, this, and I was timed. And I don't know what they did with the data. I think I dropped one BB. But there was a dexterity test. And I didn't know it was coming. I was a little nervous about it. But I mean, you bring up a good point. I mean, we do get the occasional resident who ends up not feeling comfortable with surgery. And it's nothing against that resident. That's their choice or, you know, whatever it is. But these spots are coveted spots. And there's, for every spot, there's like 100 people willing to take that spot. And so you bring up a good point. Maybe we should be getting more of a surgical commitment or some kind of assessment, because I do believe that with proper practice, anyone can be a good surgeon, or maybe not everyone, but 99% of people with proper practice, you have to want to do it. And you have to have that mentality that you're going to be, you know, pushing forward here. You know what I mean? And so... we do get the occasional resident who doesn't feel comfortable doing surgery, and it's a little disappointing because that spot is so valuable.
It sure is. I mean, part of the catch too is that we're saying that, you know, in general, for most residency spots in the US, whether any specialty, Medicare funds them.
Yes.
So they pay the university, let's just make up numbers here. They pay the university $200K a year, university pays the resident $70K a year, uses the $140K a year to teach you.
Yes.
And so, I mean, the universities could have more spots, but just have them not Medicare funded. You just got to come up with the money. So when you look at these universities now that are like mega, mega $1 million endowments, can you just have a few more spots even if Medicare doesn't pay for it? Come on, really.
Right. There is room for that, for sure. There's room for that, for sure. And maybe that's what we have to do. I mean, there's no doubt we need to be training more. And I think most places will have enough. You know, then the argument comes, okay, as you add spots, do you have the volume of cases? You know, we want the residents to get 300 cataracts, and will there be that volume? I think there is. I think in most big places, there's enough to go around.
Well, I mean, Mass Eye and Ear, which is not a high volume place in general, yeah, went from 8 residents here to 9 residents here recently.
Did they? I didn't realize that. So.
Yes, now there are two programs, which is Mass Eye and Ear and UT Southwestern 9.
I knew
the eight per year program are still like Wills,
yeah,
UCLA, maybe a couple others. Yeah. So,
no, I think it's good.
We gotta train more.
Yeah, we have to. I mean, and they still need, you can't compromise the quality, so they still need that volume. But I think there's a way to get that volume. But you know, it may take another thing. Like VA hospitals may have to let you do 15 cases a day. You know, like there's gonna have to be some changes there too, because otherwise you're gonna log jam the system. You know, so there. You know, everyone has to kind of commit to doing more in the same amount of time. And so, you know, whether you're at a county hospital or at the mothership or at a VA, you got to be able to get the residency's cases, and you have to do it in a timely manner. Like you said, like when you came in, 4 cases a day isn't going to cut it. And there are still some hospitals where the volume is very, very limited. And that's a limiting factor for the resident education.
No, for sure, for sure, for sure. Yeah, I think there is a bare minimum number of, let's say, I think you're right, somewhere in the 200-ish range, where if you get those done, you're able to learn on your own the next, you know, 1,000 cases and get really great skills going.
Yeah. I mean, so much of what we do is muscle memory and pattern recognition when you think about it. Like it's being able to see the very subtle changes. Oh, that was a little zonular weakness. I should back off for a second. You know, it's so much of it is that. It's just getting the reps in and realizing, you know, what stands out from the case before, you know, and why is this different, and just really, you know, doing capsular excess is 100% muscle memory, you know, 99.9% of the time, you know, but at the beginning you struggle with it, you grip too hard, you push on the wound, you shallow the chamber, you know, but once you figure out how to hold your hands and how to tear the capsule, it's all muscle memory.
No, very, very true. And of course, coming in the near future, anyways, the robotic stuff.
Yeah,
the robots are pretty dang good. They learn fast.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty cool. I saw a demo last year at ACOS. I think you were there too. And it's pretty.
Yeah. See what's out. That's the company I'm working with. It's Horizon Surgical Systems. It's one of my disclosures. So
yes,
but it's a neat company, and I think that's going to be a big help for the future.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the same way that keratorefractive surgery went to essentially automated robotic. I mean, we're not doing radial keratotomy anymore.
Correct.
We're not doing cryo lathing of a lenticule with keratomyelusis,
which was done not that long ago. You know, I still have a couple of patients in practice.
Right.
I never did it, but I've got those patients who, you know, have the epikeratophagia and stuff like that. It's pretty wild.
Right. So I mean, now if you look at like you do a LASIK case.
Yeah.
Okay. You put the patient on the femtosecond laser. You dock them, okay. You step on a pedal, the laser does everything.
Yeah.
You bring them over to the excimer, you lift a flap, okay. The laser tracks the eye, throws down the ablation, you put a flap down.
Yeah.
Isn't it already 90% robotic?
It is amazing. But it's what I love, and it's what I hate about it too, because as a surgeon, I don't like the lack of control. And for those few seconds when they're under suction cutting the flap, if the patient moves or loses it, you know, I don't have control over that. And I tell residents that all the time, because, you know, if I have a complication, I want it to be because I messed something up, not because, you know, something I couldn't control happened. And so, but it is, it's incredible technology. It's incredibly precise, and it's amazing what we can offer for our patients.
Right. I think we're going to end up getting that soon, or reasonably soon, with cataract surgery.
Yeah.
You're going to have evolving of the techniques and technology so that it's going to hopefully give us a higher level of precision and a higher level of safety. Yeah. And that's ultimately the goal.
For sure. And especially now as, you know, lens technology gets better. Look at how much our IOL calculations have improved nowadays. I mean, the biometers are so good. The calculations are so good. You know, it used to be, I'm sure you did this too, when I started practicing, if we had a post-LASIK patient, I'd have to try and track down their records. And it was literally a page of handwritten calculations trying to convert to an IOL calculation that would make sense for the patient. I mean, and nowadays it's just so good with some of the OCT-based biometers and things like that. So, I mean, it's amazing. But it wasn't that long ago. I was literally doing calculations by hand. That way, it was like real math, you know. And so,
Well, that's a, you know, going back to your original point, that's why the field keeps evolving, keeps going forwards. And I think it's, yeah, with the advent of AI, our group, actually, I work with my buddy John Lattice with Advanced Euclidean Solutions. And so earlier this year in February, got the U.S. patent for AI-based work for lens calculations. And that's really quite amazing. And so I think in the not too near future, you're going to have everything just fully automated. You don't have to look at, you don't have to look at a printout with 10 different formulas or 8 different formulas and say, which one do I want?
That's right.
All the math is done for you. You don't have to optimize an A constant. It's going to say, no, this is the lens power for what your goal is.
That's right.
And then it'll self-optimize. Then post-op, put the patient back on the biometer. It'll send the data to the cloud. And it'll keep re-optimizing your entire database.
Yeah, and that's happening now. It is. It's amazing. And, you know, it's going to take a little more time for all of that to gel. But, it, you know, as we feed millions of cases into these systems, you get high-quality data. It's pretty cool.
You know, I got to ask you, too, some good advice for young ophthalmologists. So our podcast is all ages. 30 to, let's say, even 80.
Yes.
And it skews towards the younger ophthalmologists in the 30s and 40s. And you've had a lot of amazing fellows that you trained, the two I mentioned, but also like my buddy Biren Megpar at Wills.
I love him. He's a great humor fellow. Yeah, I've got 22 fellows now, I think, and I'm so proud of all of them. They're doing great things in the world. Advice for young ophthalmologists is set goals for yourself and work towards those goals. You'd be amazed at what you can accomplish. And, you know, things are going to pop up that you never thought were going to happen in your career, and you have to enjoy it and run with it. And I think, you know, don't believe that you can't do something, you know, kind of manifest it and make it happen. And you may hit roadblocks along the way, and there may be some failures along the way, but if you have goals that you want to accomplish, set those goals and reevaluate, see where you are. I'm still setting goals for myself, you know, and that's how I find, you know, it's good. Each year I try and reset some goals and build on what I've done the year before and accomplish those goals in the next year. And sometimes I hit the target, sometimes I don't, sometimes I exceed, sometimes things happen that I didn't even expect. But I think that's what I would tell the young ones is, you know, don't let things get stale. Don't avoid new technology, things like that. Embrace it and be the best that you can be.
That's great advice. I mean, on the road to your goal, let's say if your goal is to be an incredible tennis player.
Yes.
Every match you win is on the road to success.
Yes.
But every match you lose is also on the same road to success.
Road to success. That's exactly right.
You're learning from it. So right. Same with this, with ophthalmology. You want to be a better and better surgeon. Even if you have a complication or a problem or an issue, they're still on the same road towards your ultimate goal.
Absolutely. And anyone who's a real surgeon, if they tell you they haven't had a complication, they're not telling the truth. They're just not telling the truth. It is impossible. You do enough surgery, you're going to have something. It's either going to be your fault or it's not your fault. And it's just a complication that happens because maybe the patient has no nodules, whatever it is. Those things are going to happen, but you're absolutely right. You're still on the same path. I used to beat myself up over complications, even though I handled them well. Like I talked to one of my retina colleagues. I'd be like, oh, I can't believe I tore that capsule, blah, blah, blah. Patient did fine. You know, it's how you handle the complication.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have complications and you have to address it. But you're absolutely right. You bring up a great point. You know, you're going to probably lose more tennis matches than you're going to win, but you might win one more in every tournament than you lost, and then you win the tournament. You know, so it's like, you know, you just have to keep the ship moving forward and not get discouraged, but acknowledge where your holes are and try and fill those holes. Like I knew I wanted to learn more about AI, so I took a 6-week certificate course at MIT last summer because I wanted to learn more about AI. So, like, do things like that, you know, acknowledge where your gaps are and fill the gaps.
Oh, what's salient and sage advice? That is so great to, I mean, it's advice I wish I would have understood when I was 20 years younger, but at least I understand it now.
Me too. We learn a lot as we go along, but I totally agree.
Oh, Rich, well, I want to thank you for doing this. I mean, the hour's already gone by. Thank you for doing this podcast with us. I really enjoyed talking to you. I think you've got some great pearls. I'm sure it's going to be a very popular episode.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure, and I admire you so much. And thanks for all you've done to contribute to our field. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we all learn together. It's a fun project. And, you know, as you say, we all learn from our complications, and we can learn from each other.
Absolutely. So thanks again.
Oh, you're welcome. I'll remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every single week. Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, where we find your podcast. Plus, of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every single day, 2,400 videos in a row and counting. So until next time, we'll catch you later.